You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy Lend Lease Episode 7, our summer podcast spinoff for 2019. We thought we would talk this week about some of the, I don't want to say drama because that trivializes what is legitimately, I think, a significant fight happening within the party for control of the future direction of the Democratic Party, but basically the feuding, I guess you could say, between the House Democratic leadership and the so-called squad of four congresswomen of color elected last year to the House that's been happening over the course of June and July, especially this year. Rachel, start us at the beginning of the timeline on things. A lot of this, the actual sort of flashpoint of things that have been building up for a while was at the end of June about the border funding bill. Could you sort of recap, Rachel, where things stood on that and how this, you know, sort of led to a open conflict?
Yeah. So, in late June, the House Democrats just basically gave a blank check to the Republicans for funding the concentration camps at the border. And this was in direct opposition to the Progressive Caucus and other progressive groups in Congress who are arguing that just giving a blank check with no like provisions on how the money is going to be spent is just feeding into the administration's cruelty and not putting any checks on what they're doing right now. So after that vote, Representative Ilhan Omar tweeted out, "A vote for Mitch McConnell's border bill is a vote to keep kids in cages and terrorize immigrant communities. How can we trust Donald Trump won't turn around and use this to fund his deportation plan or worse?" Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went on CNN's Jake Tapper's show, The Lead, after that announcement. And she said, "I do not believe we should be throwing more money to ICE. My district is 50% immigrant. I have an obligation and responsibility to protect them. I believe that what we should ideally be doing is passing a pure humanitarian bill to get money straight to the kids." Representative Pramila Jayapal, who is not part of the squad, but she is a co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, said that Senate Democrats just let the fight go. And when she was asked how exactly she would stop that from happening in the future, she said, "I'm looking for a new pharmaceutical drug that builds spines." The Congressional Hispanic Caucus, as a group, sent out a statement saying, "We will not forget this betrayal. The bill will not stop the Trump administration's chaos and cruelty," the statement said, adding, "As a result, migrants will continue to die." So this was, I don't know if the corporatist Democrats weren't really expecting this pushback. I don't think they were expecting this public criticism of their decision making and their decision to kind of go along with this vote and vote to give this money to the border concentration camps.
Well, the thing I was thinking in this was that there was sort of this mythology that got built up about Nancy Pelosi being effective at like disciplining the caucus or leading the caucus, although there's definitely some longstanding evidence to the contrary with certain votes and the right wing of the party, which keeps challenging her. I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about that, but like they keep trying to oust her as speaker and she does everything in her power to protect that wing. But the people who actually voted for her, all four of the squad members, for example, from the progressive side, she just is openly trashing them. But anyway, not to get too far off track here ahead of ourselves, what I was going to say is, in some respects, I guess she's an effective sort of floor manager and whip and everything like that. But as the speaker, like the thing that this reminded me a lot of was in the end of 2009, when sort of under the gun to get something for the health care bill passed out of the House, she just let the Stupak amendment get attached to it and then had the House Democrats vote it through, basically forcing I think it got attached using Republican votes, but then she didn't kill it. Like she didn't. She probably could have found a way to stop it, and instead just has them go vote through this package that's like significantly curtailing abortion rights in the Obamacare. And some of it got stripped out later, but the fact that she let it go through in the first place, as part of the package, I think was a huge red flag, and people were kind of outraged at the time, especially Repro Freedom groups. And then flash forward to now, I think we see a similar thing here, where just all of a sudden, despite all the work of these relevant caucuses trying to come up with a House bill, they're just like, well, the Senate already passed a bill from the Republicans, so I guess we'll just vote this one through for some reason. And a lot of the Democrats did vote against this bill, and the, like, it had to go through with Republican votes. You know, I mean, it's sort of a similar situation. There was that period when Paul Ryan's control of the House Republicans was sort of breaking down, and there were a bunch of times when stuff had to get passed using Democratic votes, and Pelosi put those together. So in this case, a little bit of a role reversal there. But like, a lot of the Democrats were pretty upset about this, even fairly mainline ones. And, you know, it's like it's showing the fractures within the party. And I think a lot of people just aren't really sure what to do about it, even within the party, because, I mean, like I said, the right flank of the party keeps challenging Pelosi and trying to take her out. So then as a result, no one to the left of her is stepping up, which then I guess you could get really cynical and conspiratorial and start suggesting that maybe she's intentionally figuring out how to have this right flank run against her every time, you know, in these failed challenges, because she knows they're not going to win, but at least it will keep the left flank in check, because it's like, well, you could have someone way worse as speaker. I mean, that's something that, like, in local and state politics happens a lot. You know, I remember in Delaware, there was a candidate for something, and they had a decent, credible challenger from not even particularly far to their left, but let's say slightly more progressive. And so they just, like, went and found, like, two or three other random people to run in the primary so that the, you know, opposition vote would get split because, I don't know who these different candidates are, I'll just vote for the incumbent or whatever, or split the votes across several challengers. I don't know if that's what's happening here, but it wouldn't surprise me if it came out later that that was something that was happening. Nate, did you want to weigh in on this part of it?
Well, I mean, I've sort of been following the whole craziness over the past couple of weeks, although I remember, the first there was the whole Maureen Dowd article, which Pelosi was like, oh, there are only four votes, and just like, just going out of her way to attack them. And I guess like it was for Maureen Dowd's like first relevant column since she like took too many edibles in Colorado and decided that they were a huge problem, I guess.
Maureen Dowd used to be such a bigger thing and then just faded into the background.
Well, I mean, she spent the whole Lewinsky like scandal trashing her, so, I mean, she sort of built up that. But anyway, but then, like, I remember I went to see a movie, I think it was Midsommar, and I got out and the timeline was just, you know, in flames or whatever because of that whole situation where it's like, well, we're going to go after the chief of staff of AOC. There was like this long profile of AOC's chief of staff, Saikat Chakrabarty, in the Washington Post. I remember like it might have been that morning. And then like they seized on like a tweet he had made about Representative Charisse Davids talking about how she went along with basically the blank check there at the border. And then it was like someone coming from Hakeem Jeffries' staff was like, keep her name out your mouth. Like, it was this whole, like, very bizarre, extremely online, just, like, you wouldn't get it unless you spent all your time on Twitter. And it was
right.
It
was weird to have this feud thing. And I mean, that speaks to the Pelosi quote. All these people have their public, all these people have their public whatever and their Twitter world, but they didn't have any following. So, like, she also is saying that this is, it's the same thing. It's like when people, you know, including us, go on Twitter all day and then complain about people being on Twitter all day and being really insular, right? Like, it ends up being this sort of weird self cycle with where only the other people are bad.
It's weird, though, when you have, like Pelosi's, communications director, Drew Hamill, was, like, retweeting it and, like,
And then
like
he said
Pelosi
that he was bullied because he was gay or something like that. So therefore, he couldn't possibly be a bully in this situation.
So therefore,
he's like in his
40s. Democrats. Yeah.
The thing I wanted to talk a little bit about the Hakeem Jeffries thing as well. So for those who missed that, there was this other fight for control of the House Democratic Caucus chair position or whatever you want to call it. which is sort of a relatively high ranking leadership thing, but it's not as significant as you know the extreme upper levels anyway. And so back in the like after the last election, there had been an election for that, and Barbara Lee from California, who's a fantastic progressive, just beloved by a lot of people. It was a similar sandbagging as with the Ellison versus Perez fight for the DNC chairmanship, which was that a lot of people, you know, this is a beloved progressive, but who's also part of the establishment and relatively well respected and so forth, gets a lot of support lined up. All of a sudden, this other candidate appears who everyone's like, who is this guy? And, you know, basically gets installed to block the progressives from having even a shred of symbolic power within the party. So Barbara Lee loses to this congressman from New York City, Hakeem Jeffries. And I guess it's possible that after the redistricting in New York, if New York loses a seat, they are potentially going to try to remove AOC's district and just basically fold it into Hakeem Jeffries' district. They have adjoining districts. Now, who knows if that's actually true or just sort of the rumor mill. But he's a machine politician who was very close with Joe Crowley. And Joe Crowley, like, worked the phones harassing a lot of House Democrats after having lost the seat to, like, support Hakeem Jeffries. But anyway, so there's even possibility that Jeffries himself, not staff, sent that tweet. It was a very bizarre tweet, and he just didn't delete it. They didn't apologize for it. They said it was intentional, just attacking AOC's chief of staff. It was absolutely bizarre.
Well, there was a demand that she fire him as well. It's like, oh, that's what's expected in Washington. And then she just, of course, didn't. So, and then there was some weird sniping too, between like the Congressional Black Caucus and Ayanna Pressley. And of course the Congressional Black Caucus did not endorse her during her primary here in my district.
So they supported Mike Capuano, the white incumbent. And I mean, the CBC, like, this is a tough one because, you know, on some stuff, the CBC is, you know, very respected and working hard for advancing African-American issues. But the CBC also has a PAC. And sometimes it gets a little blurred in the media coverage of this because there's the Political Action Committee wing and then the, like, actual caucus itself. Now, the caucus has done some kind of sketchy stuff in the past, like, for example, Steve Cohen in Tennessee, who's, you know, white Jewish congressman from a majority black district. When he got elected, he asked to be part of the Congressional Black Caucus to help represent his constituents better, and they said no, which was not probably great. And then to this day, I think he's still not in it. But the bigger issue with the CBC is this PAC, which takes an enormous amount of corporate money, and a lot of the people involved with the PAC and then some of their former members, even high ranking people like Charlie Rangel, have been caught up in very serious corruption scandals with, you know, these various corporations that they're affiliated to. So, like, they were trying to, for some reason, really go after Ayanna Pressley for various reasons, which that is also very bizarre. If, for those who are not from Massachusetts politics, Ayanna Pressley is an extremely mainstream. I mean, she's progressive, don't get me wrong, but she is an extremely mainstream establishment politician. She is incredibly tightly connected in with Massachusetts Democratic Party politics. A lot of people stayed on the sidelines in her primary challenge against Capuano, which is, you know, not the case for something like AOC versus Crowley. They stayed on the sidelines because they want to have Pressley support whether or not she wins for their race. She was someone who would go around giving speeches on behalf of them and that sort of thing. She's very charismatic, etc. Everyone here, you know, really likes her and admires her. Obviously, there were some people who were upset that she was doing a primary challenge, but most people just kept their mouth shut about it. And so Pelosi targeting her on the same footing as these other congresswomen, which I don't even think, I mean, with Ilhan Omar, I don't even think there was a primary for that one. So, like, that was an open seat. Anyway, targeting Pressley in this way is sort of bizarre. But then the CBC, like, going after her was just super weird. But the other thing is this, you know, this, which, you know, ties into the Rangel thing that I mentioned, a lot of these CBC people and stuff, there's overlap with the New York machine politics that Crowley's involved in. So basically, there's a huge component of this that seems to be an internal fight, not even for control of the National Democratic Party, but just for control of the Democratic Party within the counties of New York City, which is kind of a weird thing to consider. I mean, that's a real throwback to like the 19th century, you know, where, oh, New York, you know, internal politics is going to decide the control of the party. Anyway, so that's sort of like another bizarre thing that's going on. And then there were two things that Trump seized on. One, he was seizing on like Pelosi's attacks on these four women to like alternately snipe at Pelosi and then the four women. And then also the House Democrats paid for and released this poll by Axios, the horrible access journalism, corporate journalism thing in Washington, where they had them do a poll that was like popularity levels among whites with no college or limited college education. And they were like, yeah, these congresswomen are really unpopular with this demographic that for some reason we think is the key demographic that we need to be winning, which makes no sense at all. I mean, there was a statistic that got brought up a number of times in 2016 that said if the racial coalition, in 1984 for Walter Mondale, you know, held up with the same percentages of like, you know, among black people, X percentage voted for the Democratic nominee, among Hispanics, Y percentage voted for the Democratic nominee, et cetera, you know, and then among whites, you get this percentage among this, like various different breakdowns. If you extended that to 2016, a Democratic candidate would win in a landslide. The only reason that the Republicans won in a landslide was because it was a much, much whiter country at the time. If that coalition were the same today, the Democrats would crush it. I mean, that's essentially if there is a such thing as an Obama coalition in 2008 and then to a lesser extent 2012, a lot of that is just motivating a lot of people, whether they're poor whites or African-Americans or Latinos or whoever, to come out and vote for your Democratic candidates, giving them a reason to come out and vote. That gives you these significant electoral victories. Relying on some sort of weird so-called Reagan Democrats thing doesn't make any sense. Those people, Reagan was a long time ago. He was over 30 years ago. If they've been voting for the Republicans that long, they're Republicans. They're not Democrats anymore. A lot of them were in the South and switched parties, or if they're in the North, they're not coming back. So you have to come up with a different coalition. Obviously, some white people are going to vote for you, and that's fine. But this idea of just like, oh, we have to determine the entire party direction based on what a poll of people who bothered to answer their phone, who are lower income whites without a college degree, that's a bizarre metric to be going for. The whole thing about these candidates, whether it's, you know, Ilhan Omar or Rashida Tlaib or AOC or Ayanna Pressley, the whole thing about Bernie Sanders, any of these things, is that they're potentially activating and mobilizing an entirely different segment of the potential electorate, as opposed to just increasingly fighting over a narrowing and narrowing and narrowing electorate, which Hillary Clinton tried to do and failed. The election outcome in 2016 was entirely decided by turnout levels. Some of that was voter suppression, but a lot of it was also just voter disaffectation and that sort of thing. So the idea that you're going to go after these people because they're not targeting, you know, they're not polling well among a demographic that isn't particularly interested in what the Democratic Party has to offer and isn't going to be interested for the most part unless things radically change, then what is the point of that, right? Like, I don't care if they're like, oh, well, Fox News told me these people are bad. Like, I don't care. That's not who they appeal to. That's not the point. Like, we're trying to build a new coalition that's going to mobilize more people to get out there and get involved, because so much of the American people just doesn't participate in any of this stuff. And with good reason. They're not being offered anything. I mean, that's the whole problem with the Biden campaign, is just constantly trashing anybody that doesn't agree with him and being like, well, they don't actually disagree with me on this, or they're not actually going to vote, or they're not actually radical, they don't actually want these changes, etc. And, you know, it's the same thing too with the lack of a climate debate, as we've talked about, right? You want young people to come out and vote, but then you're like, well, their number one issue doesn't get enough good ratings and isn't a high enough priority for the non-young voters, so we don't care about it, which does not make any sense. I mean, like, Obama was able to move the needle on youth turnout significantly, almost entirely by being like, we're going to do some mild reforms to college student loans. And like, that was the pitch that he made. And that was enough to get a lot of young people out in 2008. John Kerry, for God's sakes, turned out a ton of young people to vote you know, but basically because of these, you know, foreign policy issues that people were so upset about under George W. Bush. This is just this bizarre narrative that they've come up with. And that's why I say this is fundamentally a fight for control of the Democratic Party. It's not just a weird Twitter feud or like, you know, Real Housewives drama or whatever. This is a significant thing that's happening. And we're seeing these little flashes of it. And it's very, very clear that the Democratic Party leadership is unwilling to relinquish any control. That's why we see these bizarrely contentious fights over even minor symbolic positions like the caucus chair and things like that, where they're like, we have to defeat Barbara Lee at all costs, even though everyone likes Barbara Lee and she's fine. And she's not gonna, I mean, I think she's great, but she also wouldn't have like been crazily rocking the boat for those guys either. So it doesn't make any sense, you know? And so that, yeah, that's where I'm at on that.
Well, there was also, as we were talking about before, the tweet from Jake Tapper about the anonymous Democrats and staffers were like, oh, the president won this round and now the squad is the Democrats now and we'll never win again. Something to that effect.
Well, and there was also all those House Democratic staffers doing things anonymously and on background where they're just purely sniping. Oh, and some of them were actual Congress members, just anonymously sniping at the Democrats they didn't like to their left and saying like, you know, what was the really controversial one was the hand puppet one, where it was like a white person's arm inside a brown hand puppet, a Goomba from Mario, and saying
like,
that
doesn't even make any sense.
The implication there was like, these are ostensibly brown members of Congress who are being hand puppeted by white gentrifiers. Because that was the narrative that they also used against someone like Ayanna Pressley, who drove enormous turnout among Black and Latino voters in Boston as part of her victory, and propelled, and she propelled a bunch of lower candidates on the ballot, Latino candidates and Black candidates and Afro Latino candidates into office lower on the ballot, and also the African American DA, right? Those were all on the same day, and the idea that, oh, this, no, it's the Cambridge and Somerville white gentrifiers, you know, that propelled her to office. And the same thing, they'll make that accusation against AOC. It's ludicrous. This doesn't make any sense, and it's so offensive. And also, even if somehow you were able to cobble together some argument along those lines, that's not who they're representing. They're representing the what should be the new face of the party, the new base of the party. They are representing a multivariate coalition, a multiracial, multi-faith coalition, a new, much more expansive base of people that could potentially be mobilized to come out and vote. That's who they're representing. That's and this idea, they only represent people in Minneapolis or in Dearborn or Detroit or in the Bronx or whatever, you know, and they can't speak to real America. I mean, that doesn't understand the full arc of the population across the entire country. It's not just a country of there's some dark colored, you know, swarthy cities, and then these, you know, white Ford F-150 drivers in the exurbs that are the real Americans. I mean, that's a ludicrous way of looking at this country by people who also clearly have never left their own, you know, cities either. It doesn't make any sense. It's like the whole thing too of the implicit assumption that kept getting, you know, hammered away at in you know, the real Americans in the, you know, these states like Ohio or whatever. And it's like, who do you think lives in Ohio? Who do you think, like, do you think it's all white people in Ohio? Is that what you think when you see the Electoral College map, you know, and they're filling in Ohio? You think what you're telling me is you think that that's white people in Ohio or white people in Wisconsin? No, these are cities that have significant, very sizable Black populations.
Milwaukee,
and
extremely white city, no Black people live there.
Yeah, and I mean, because I think we just talked about that, you know, a couple weeks ago on the show, right? Like these multiracial left-leaning coalitions in these cities. I mean, it's like you had people like saying that about Michigan too, of all places.
No, like, oh yeah, Hawaii was famously too white, because they voted for Bernie.
Right. So Hawaii, where there's currently protests happening by the Native Hawaiians against actions by the government there, and so forth. That's suddenly a white state. I mean, that's literally not backed up by the demographics, but sure, okay. And then Detroit, like implying heavily that that Detroit was filled with white people. Like, who is buying this stuff? They're just, everyone's brains have completely broken. There's no, like, there's no common sense applied to any of it. And then they just, like, roll over when Trump starts, you know, saying these horrible things. I mean, they couldn't even get their act together to condemn him for his, you know, go back to where you came from comments and so forth for their Somali American representative. Rachel, you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I just want to point out that these centrist Dems are really complaining about the squad, like, sucking all the oxygen out of the room and controlling the narrative. But The truth is, centrist Democrats are the ones that are, like, blocking these massively popular efforts to pass bills that would help people. Centrist Democrats just recently blocked a bill that would allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices, that famously unpopular thing, negotiating lower drug prices for sick people. So unpopular. Such a niche issue, obviously. Or, like, the Trump administration is trying to lower standards on pollution and adding, like, dumping chemicals in the water supply, poisoning children, obviously very popular. So blocking efforts to stop corporations from dumping chemicals in the water supply, definitely a great idea. So it's just, yeah, like, it's so stupid on its face that this squad is, like, this super niche, like, group and representing a super niche constituency, when it's the opposite is true, and that the centrist Democrats are blocking these massively popular like $15 minimum wage. Obviously, that's popular amongst the working class. So it's just it's really dumb. That's a stupid argument. Trying to marginalize these marginalized women and their incredibly popular message is not going to turn out the vote in 2020. Attacking voter suppression in that New York machine article from HuffPo. I think it was HuffPo, right? Or was
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So pointing to that New York machine, the Justice Democrats were trying to get Tiffany Caban elected as the DA in Queens. And the machine has kind of pulled some levers and stopped counting ballots that were voting for Tiffany Caban. And so now Melinda Katz is in the lead currently, I believe. I don't think Caban has conceded yet, but I think you can see how that is affecting voter enthusiasm.
They stole a lot of that election, flat
exactly.
out. They stole it.
Yeah.
Not even a question in my mind. Absolutely
yeah.
stole that election.
And so voters see that, and it's obviously going to dampen enthusiasm for voting if you are witnessing the Democratic machine tampering with an election in real time. That's not going to get people turned out to vote for 2020, and that's how we win. It's a numbers game. If you are reaching out to these, like you said, these, like, Reagan Democrats, we're going to lose. We saw it happen in 2016. We need to do everything we can to stop it from happening in 2020. And it looks like the party leaders are just really not interested in stopping another 2016 from happening again. And it's really disheartening to see it happening in real time while the stakes are so high. Like, there's concentration camps, for God's sake. Like, why are we attacking the progressive wing of our party when there's, like, atrocities happening right before our eyes? It's so stupid.
And I mean, broader than this fight for the control of the Democratic Party, I think it speaks to this issue as well. People have been speculating for a while now, like, you know, as capitalism enters this crisis and there's, you know, so much inequality and so many people are so upset and angry, you know, are we going to see a New Deal style, you know, mildly social democratic concession toward the left just to basically appease people and not have a full blown meltdown? And I think the answer we're seeing is no. They are not going to make those concessions. Again, the fact that they can't make symbolic concessions for, like, minor leadership things, the fact that they you know, keep saying, well, this stuff, the squad, you know, they're getting too much media attention, blah, blah, blah. And it's all a distraction from the real work. The same thing they say about impeachment, too. We can't do impeachment because it's distracting us from the real work that we're supposed to be working on or whatever. And it's like, what are you talking about? What work? You're not doing anything. They won't do anything. As Rachel just listed off a whole bunch of examples of things they've been killing, they will not do anything, not even mild things, right? Because for, you know, under the Obama years and so forth, and for years now, right, the liberal centrist defenders of the party, right, you know you can't say that they're the same thing as the Republicans, blah, 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 because that's not true. You know, maybe you don't like how that it's not going as far as you want, but they're doing X, Y, and Z things. Okay, fine, that was maybe that was true under the Obama administration. Maybe that was even true in the period under George W. Bush, where we controlled both chambers, right? They weren't passing a whole lot of stuff because he could potentially veto it, but they were still passing some things. Did it go as far as we wanted? Did it go as far as we needed? No, absolutely not. But you could at least make that claim that, like, oh, they're at least making these minor concessions, right? That is no longer happening. That is not happening right now, nor will it be happening, even if we elect a Democratic president under the current leadership and the style that the leadership is taking. And I'm not confident that there's going to be any change in that either, even if we do elect a Democratic president, right? This is the problem that we have right now, is that both parties have arrived at a point where they're not willing to make any concessions, however mild, in a social democratic direction, even as the system is on the precipice, about to go into free fall, as we are at the end point where none of this stuff is going to continue working, right? Between climate change, between these various VC bubbles, between everything else that's happening, but the point that we are at in history, this is not going to continue to be sustainable. And as we've said before on the show, right, the only way this can go is it can either go in a hard right direction where you're using extensive force to prop up this system, or you go in a significantly left direction and transform the existing system completely that we have, and that's going to require a much bigger change than they're clearly prepared to undertake. So they are just not making any concessions whatsoever, and I don't think they're going to. Nate?
Yeah, I was just going to say this weekend in particular is kind of representative of the impending climate crisis because of the heat wave across the country and just the preview of what's to come, I guess, and I guess, yeah, your pessimism over the Democrats, whether they're going to get their act in gear, I think is a lot of us share it. And then, of course, there's the whole, like, we talked a little about this before, but the way that the Republicans have just sort of, like, have this ready-made narrative about how all these squad members, they're all anti-Semitic. They're all, you know, therefore any, you know, we can say, you know, go back to Somalia or whatever, and it's fine. Because they're the real racists. And then this is just like legitimized and gobbled up by the same Democrats who were, you know, going to condemn Omar for her alleged anti-Semitism and all of that. And it's, you know, it just between the Twitter shenanigans and, you know, it's all just in such bad faith. And it's a lot of it just really tiring. And you're sort of just like, why should I do anything for you or ever listen to what any of you have to say ever? Or anyone who takes your advice seriously, should I ever listen to them? Probably not, no. So,
and I mean, I feel like you and I, Nate, I can't speak to Rachel's experience because I didn't meet Rachel until much later, but like you and I have been in the trenches on this since probably when we were in high school. Like we were following this stuff pretty closely and exasperated with the party leadership and the direction of the party.
Our brains are fully melted.
Yeah, and I feel, you know, I have long maintained the position that you have to take over the party because the party as an institution is, it does have substantial power, right? And legally it is baked in. Like that's the thing too. You know, if someone says, oh, you know, start a third party or whatever, there are, let alone federal laws, there are many states that have immense hurdles legally baked into the election system against any party outside of the two major parties, right? I mean, we've talked about this on previous episodes. There are states, especially in the South, where like, for example, to run as an independent or third party for governor, you have to collect, you know, 50,000 signatures or something like that, you know, 20,000, like there are substantial hurdles that are only applied to the outside parties and not applied to the major parties. We have similar restrictions or hurdles in Massachusetts that create various problems. I realistically do not see, especially if we're talking about a, you know, let's say a 12-year timeline, or to be generous, we'll say 12 years. It's really not that effectively, but let's say 12 years as a bench, as a ballpark figure, to turn things around on climate change, right? But of course, if it took you 12 years, then it would already be too late. But let's say, okay, you know, you've got a very limited window of time. Well, you're not going to build up a new party in that amount of time. So the only option left is essentially to take over this, you know, this monolith party that is completely calcified and stultified and is actively resisting any sort of changes, et cetera. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know what to, you know, it's, that's also, it appears probably not going to be feasible over that timeline either. So, which is not to say, okay, everyone, like, it's all hope is lost, give up or whatever. Like, we've talked about this before. You have to continue fighting until it actually is too late, right? You can't stop fighting because you never know. Something significant, there might be a sea change. There might be a window of opportunity. You never know what is going to be, you know, the deus ex machina. Obviously, you can't count on that, but you don't want to stop fighting prematurely. So obviously, you have to continue with that. And in our case, that also means continuing to fight to, you know, take over the party. But I mean, this thinking, it doesn't, it's not just a few people at the top, right? You're not going to change this by just removing Pelosi or something like that, because it pervades the entire party all the way down to the ground level. A few weeks ago, I was at a city Democratic committee meeting. We had high school students there in the room who had brought forward a thing in support of a climate debate. And one of the senior ranking, like highest ranking people from the state Democratic Party was there and was trying to discourage them from pushing for this climate debate, and said out loud in front of these high school students, "We can't act like children demanding to have an entire pie for dinner." That was her comparison to asking for a debate on the single largest, yeah, most existential civilizational level issue. Was, well, to say it's one, acting like children, which they were literally, yeah, children, acting like children to demand a debate on climate change, and a whole debate on climate change, because that's like asking for an entire pie for dinner. That, well, is
like
the thinking.
Feinstein thing.
This, yeah, is, yeah, this is the thinking that pervades the entire party leadership from top to bottom. They are going to fight you every step of the way and be unwilling to relinquish power. But again, I want to stress that does not mean you should stop fighting or give up on that, because I personally think you have to continue fighting and making that case as long as you possibly can, to the last man, to the last woman, right? You have to continue that fight. And it doesn't, if it's not your thing to work on the party stuff, there's lots of other stuff that's going on, you know, around that people can get involved with. And I certainly encourage people to do that. For me, this is the track that I've been on for more than, you know, a decade at this point. So to me, it doesn't really make sense for me to leave, you know, and give up on any of the work that I've been building on that. Right. I don't know how much traction I've actually made, but my view at this point is I can only do what I can to position myself to be in place if a moment arises, if a window opens, if a door opens, if there is a moment in time where there's an opportunity for us to go to the left instead of going to the far right. We have to have people in place to take that opportunity. I mean, you know, I'm currently, as people know, running for city council in my city. And people will say, "I don't know that you're going to be able to get that much done on, you know, the issues that you care about." Well, you know, if I get elected, right, worst case scenario, I'll probably be able to make some minor improvements here and there that improve people's lives. And, you know, I can maybe help them get a pothole dealt with or something, whatever. And it'll make someone's life better. Right. That's like the worst case scenario. If I do get elected, best case scenario is that I'm on the city council and in a position to potentially do something if we have a sudden sea change and a window of opportunity opens up. You never know when that's going to happen. Most of the time you can't recognize, you can recognize that you're in a period of turmoil and potential change often, but you don't necessarily have a good sense of like, oh, everything is about to change and I know what direction it's going to be. That's not you're never going to get that sort of level of foresight. You can only put yourself in a position, be prepared, have the training you need, etc., to step up when there's a moment that opens up, if one opens up. I don't know if one will open up in time, right? But you have to get yourself into the position, and you have to keep fighting, and you have to keep making that case. I mean, the thing that we've talked about before with someone like Bernie Sanders or someone like Jeremy Corbyn, and a lot of people have talked about this, why is it that they had their moment, you know, around 2015, 2016, 2017? Where is it that these older guys are emerging from? Well, it's because they're the only ones who are left who are still in position to take advantage of this movement and moment, who have been consistently speaking out vocally the entire time, right? People like Jeremy Corbyn were speaking out against things like the Iraq War and various other imperial actions. They were speaking out on the right side of social issues, of economic issues, etc. Same thing with Bernie Sanders, right? That is the position that a lot of these guys have been in, is they are the only people that have consistently for, you know, more than 30 years now been in not even the spotlight, you can't really say, right? Because they were generally on the back bench and having relatively limited roles, but they've been consistent over their careers. They've been vocal over their careers. It's easy to check their record. So being in position is already half the battle. That's why it's great to have people like AOC in place, even if they're feeling relatively isolated and being marginalized and potentially put in danger by the leadership and the leadership's lack of support for them, because now we are at least starting to get people into position if there is a significant change. And there may come a moment where some of these people that have been totally intractable suddenly realize, oh no, I've made a terrible mistake, and it's, we have this option toward our left, or we're going to full-blown fascism. And some of them are going to choose the wrong thing in that moment, but some of them will say, oh, I've made a terrible mistake, we have to go to the left option. It's the only humane option that recognizes our common humanity on a global level, on a national level, on a local level, that understands that there is a better way that we can structure our society and structure our economy, that there is a better way of doing things on this planet that is more humane and lifts up all of us at the common level and gets us all to a better place and a survivable place where we can survive the travesties that have been put upon us through this climate crisis that they have engineered, through the actions of the capital system that is completely dysfunctional at this point and is totally breaking down. You have to have people in position and in place. You have to have people on the ground level working on these things to step up when the moment arrives. We don't know if that moment will arrive, but you have to have people in place. That's the fight that we're currently having. And even though it is incredibly discouraging and infuriating to watch this stuff unfold, this is part of a bigger struggle that is happening. And even if you are currently losing this struggle, you have to continue on it, because there may come a day when suddenly everything changes and you have a very narrow window of opportunity to seize on it and capitalize on it. That's it for me. I don't know what you guys have to say.
I was going to say, are you going to do a transition, or
I mean, did we cover everything? I don't know.
I think we got through most of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Rachel, thank you so much for being on again this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Nate, thanks for being on as well.
Thanks a lot.